Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Kai Wortmann, the co-host of the channel, and I'm here today with Emil Boyesen to talk about his new book, Forms of Education, Rethinking Educational Experience Against and Outside the Humanist Legacy. That was an extremely stimulating read, so I'm really happy to have you, the author here. Emil, welcome to the New Books in Education.
Thank you very much, Kai. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before talking about the book, can you maybe start off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you into education?
So my background was actually in literature. So my first degree was in literature. And then my second degree, my PhD, was in literature and philosophy. And then as I was studying philosophy and thinking about all sorts of things, as you do when you study philosophy, I started to think about the social impact of the works that I was studying, the ideas that I was studying. And it became obvious to me that I didn't really feel as at home in a philosophy department as I might have first thought. And a job came up in the education department at the university that I was doing my PhD in, which is the University of Winchester, where I am now. And I heard on the grapevine they were looking for a theoretical person. And without too much experience in the field of education, I applied for the job. And I think I was convincing enough at least to get the job. And then from then on, this was 10, 11 years ago now, I've been totally addicted to studying education, thinking about education, but most of all, trying to apply serious philosophical thought to educational concepts and practices and experiences, and that's what's brought me to where I am now. And now I'm a reader in education in an education department in Winchester.
And so that was how you came to education as a discipline. And what kind of questions are you, before going into details about your book, but what kind of general questions are the most interesting for you in education, as a field more generally?
So I really irritate people with my answer to this question because it's never what they expect. So often when you ask an educationalist what are they most interested when it comes to thinking about education, and they'll reply with some specific question around curriculum or practice or something like that. I'm really irritating in that my answer to that question is, what is education? And I'm really interested in trying to figure out what it is, how broadly we can understand it, and what that means for how we practice it and how our society is organized and how we consider our development or non-development as individuals. I mean, I could go into that a lot more deeply, as I'm sure I will be able to when I talk about the book a bit more. But that's the fundamental question for me, is what is education? And to me, that is it means that education becomes not just an object of critique or study or philosophical analysis, but actually also you read it back into the philosophy itself. What was the education that produced my ability to philosophize in this way? Because philosophy itself as a discipline or as a practice is also a product of education. So philosophically, for me also, as well as educationally, the most interesting question is, what is education?
That's the philosophical question, right? What is X, Y, Z? So let us start with your books, with your book, and maybe with the title. I read it again: Forms of Education, Rethinking Educational Experience Against and Outside the Humanist Legacy. And what is the humanist legacy in education?
Good question. So sorry for the long title. It's one of those titles where you sort of try to make sure that you cover enough of what you're talking about so it's not misleading. But that's why I wanted the punchy main title, and I was lucky to be able to keep that. So, but the humanist legacy, I think is I think I go with a relatively common understanding of what the humanist legacy is, which is a legacy that was developed primarily in the 15th and 16th century in Europe throughout the Renaissance, so through the Renaissance humanists, where they were inheriting some of the principles and ideas and even practices of the ancient Roman philosophers and really educationalists. And what they did was they took some of those practices and they applied that to schooling in such a way and at such a time when schooling was being expanded that they could really, I guess, define what education has come to mean for subsequent generations. So what the humanist legacy in education is an intellectualized and formalized practice of education stemming from ancient Rome, coming through the European Renaissance, and then into educational practice, European-style educational practice, as it has now come to infect, to use a slightly loaded term, more than a slightly loaded term, very much a global way of thinking about education and what an educated subject is. So by subject, I mean an educated individual, what an educated individual is, and what we should value in education, and so on and so forth. But importantly, one of the important things about the humanist legacy is not just what it includes, because what it includes has changed in terms of content. So in the Renaissance, there was a lot of teaching of rhetoric. And now, for example, that was one of the primary objects of Renaissance humanist education, whereas now we don't teach rhetoric in any ordinary sense, but still so much of what we study has rhetorical components, which is something I could come back to. But the point is that there's this long tradition of a very narrow, relatively speaking, tradition of education, which I think still plays a huge part in how we think about and practice education today. And so the book is an attempt to describe what that is, and then unpack it and critique it and think about other ways of thinking about education which don't necessarily follow from that tradition in a direct manner, but that are nonetheless always going to be influenced by it because it's so pervasive.
Okay, before we go into your alternatives you propose, maybe you can talk a bit about what the problem is with this legacy or what the problem is that you see.
Yeah, so I think there's quite a few problems, and they connect to lots of critiques that we see in contemporary education. So lots of critiques in contemporary educational theory or in educational policy critiques focus on the issues that we, the problem, not the, the critiques are mostly negative quite often, trying to figure out why certain decisions have been made, why certain policies have been put into play. And it's, we can talk about neoliberal policy and things like that. But what I try and do is actually take a step back from that and not just engage in a critique of contemporary educational norms as exhibiting neoliberal traits and therefore being terrible, which, I think people are right to engage in those kinds of critiques. But what I try and do is take a step back from that and say, okay, well, what is the kind of education that we think would be better than this neoliberal form of education that we've developed and that we are so uncomfortable with and unhappy with? And often the answer to that question is a form of liberal education, which is very much about the development of the individual as a kind of singular competent being who, through their education, reaches some kind of enlightenment, really, I think is implied, that they otherwise wouldn't have achieved. And there's a lot of problems with that, because I think there's I mean, clearly, the first problem, of course, is that it creates a kind of aristocracy of education. So the people who receive the most substantial education are therefore somehow more enlightened than those who are not. And obviously, that's an oversimplification, but it's implicit in that logic. The other component of humanist education, and just to say that those components of humanist education that are common in the liberal tradition also are inherited, but in a very superficial form in the neoliberal tradition, which is about qualifications and outcomes and systems of accountability and so on. So it becomes about how can you account for your development? How can you account for your value? How can you account for your worth? And we know so often that that worth is not given necessarily in terms of your individual ability or understanding or intellect. It's often given by what you've come to be associated with, which is something that is commonly connected to your background and your ability to engage in particular circles, go to particular schools or particular universities and so on. So there's many issues when it comes to the humanist legacy, some of which are through its development in terms of the neoliberal tradition, which also comes from that legacy, absolutely. But also, I think some issues that come from the liberal tradition, which seems to create a very specific notion of educational value and what an educated person is, which then opposes it to the non-educated person, which is the non-educated person or the less educated person, either within our own societies or globally. And that causes all sorts of problems which relate to big issues that, you know, I hopefully are relatively apparent, such as racism or the educational enforcement that we see kind of globally at the moment, where very westernized forms of educational attainment are seen as the gold standard and therefore imposed or seen as the kind of end goal of people who are excluded from those systems. And therefore, we need to create systems which include them. And I look at a lot of work in my book, which analyzes that, critiques that, and suggests that possibly education is not the solution to our problems. And one of the main things that the questions that I kind of come back to when thinking about the humanist legacy in education is its absolute certainty in education as being the solution to pretty much everything. You know, education is the primary and sufficient means of making a person's life better, making them more valuable, making them more aware of themselves, and making them a better contributor to society, and so on and so forth. And I think part of what I want to do with my work in general, but with this book too, is puncture that notion that education is necessarily the solution to our problems, and certainly puncture the notion that it's the solution to lots of social issues that we face. So rather than, for example, governments dealing with quite expansive social issues, we could name so many, they suggest education is the solution. So education is the means by which we create equality. Education is the means by which we offer equality of opportunity or something like that. And then it becomes a kind of get out of jail free clause for a society to say, well, we are doing lots to be able to break the barriers that people face to living successful and happy lives, but because we offer education. And so the humanist legacy in education is almost this addiction that we have to the idea of education as a solution to our problems, personally and socially.
I really like the metaphor of education as being a firefighter, right? Whenever a social problem comes up, the educators and the politicians say, oh, well, the solution must be more education. And then everyone says, okay, let's do more education. And it seems to be the solution for whatever problem comes up. Mm-hmm. You instead propose that every person already is an educated person. Can you expand on that?
That's exactly right. I'll come back to that in 1 second, because just to take your firefighter metaphor, like I would say I would agree with you completely, and I would go further and say that actually what's happening is that education is seen as the solution, but the firefighters are armed with petrol, you know, rather than water. And what they do is they perpetuate those social issues, those social divides, the issues that we find, not on purpose. You know, it's not the educators. I mean, most educators Well, yeah, that's too easy. That's an easy thing for a philosopher to say, but I mean, most educators. If I was a social scientist, I might be a little bit more careful about that. But it seems clear that a lot of educators are totally committed to their students, making their lives better, doing things that are going to improve the quality of their life and social conditions more broadly. But what often happens, and what seems to, well, it's, you know, that is one thing I'm very aware of, is the data around inequality. And we see how inequality just continues to increase. And it's, you know, when it comes to wealth, when it comes to income, when it comes to affordability of housing, and for young people, you know, now with so few jobs, for example, in the UK or the US, education is clearly not the solution to that problem, even though then institutions are often penalized precisely because they don't create employable students, whereas what's happening is there's problems with the economy and so on. So anyway, so just to take your firefighters metaphor, but what you asked as well was about the educated subject and how everyone is an educated subject. That was what you asked. Right. So this is a big thing for me. And it's another thing where I guess I might annoy people with the same thing about, you know, what's my main question when it comes to education as well as education? Because I when people say, well, who do you think is an educated subject? What does it constitute to be educated? And I would say, well, you know, to be alive is to be, you know, as a human being is to be educated. And that's because I think so many experiences that exceed formal education or even kind of quasi formal education or things that we designate as informal education, but actually in quite formal ways, there's all forms of educational experience that expand far beyond that. You know, examples I like to give are the education that occurs between friends or the education that occurs between you and your interests or passions or the education that you experience, even just in relation to yourself. As you grow and develop, and not necessarily in a linear manner. And that's another thing about the educated person, is that I don't think our educational journey is linear. And I think often, and psychologically, we can see how this makes sense as well, is that we can learn things and we can learn ways of being or to be, you know, to be in a better state of mind or something like that. If we were suffering from depression or something like that, we can learn to be in a better state of mind. But then that unravels. And then the things that we learn that allow us and the experiences that we learn are the ones that we need to be attracted to, then sometimes crumble and fall away and we fall back into depression or we fall back into bad habits or, well, for example. And I think that, so education is, you know, if we see it as I'm going to, you know, study and pass these exams or get this degree and accumulate this knowledge and these certificates and so on and so forth, it's very easy to see education in a linear fashion, or as the development of a particular skill, for example, where you learn a skill and then you develop that skill and, you know, you become really good at that. But those are very kind of limited ways of thinking about education. But for me, education expands far beyond that and extends into all of our relations, which aren't just relations between people, but us, between us and objects, between us and our thoughts, between us and our dreams, you know. I think our dreams can educate us as well. And I think, yeah, there's been some very famous and very interesting writing on that.
So you said that to be alive means to be educated. But is then, is life education, is it like the same? Or is really education a part of life and there is still something else going on in life apart from education? So I can see that potentially all kinds of experiences in life can be educational. But I wonder whether you hold that all experiences are per se educational.
I think that, I mean, to me, that's the kind of crucial crux question. And it's, I kind of dive into that a bit in the book, as you know. And it's a difficult one because I don't want to say yes. I don't want to say yes, all experiences are educational. And it, you know, that opens everything up. And it means that education becomes a non-concept and it becomes kind of irrelevant. And then how do we distinguish between what's educational and what's not? But then I really think about it some more and I go, why not? why not expand it in that way? And instead of, and of course, that makes it then more complicated. And it means that we have to say, well, okay, so yeah. So if we're saying that all experiences have the potential to be educational, what are the different kinds of educational experiences that we can have? And in what ways are they differently educational? Because I think a lot of work in philosophy of education or educational theory that tries to either implicitly, sometimes explicitly, but usually more implicitly, answer the question, what is education? Try to come up with like a limited notion of what that is. And I'm not so afraid of, I mean, I'm a little bit afraid of that in terms of what that means for how we limit our thought and our practice and our philosophy when it comes to apply to other things as well. But I guess for me, I don't mind doing that, but only if it's a really, really broad notion of what education is. So instead of creating a constrained notion of what educational experience might be and saying, well, this is what educational experience is, this is how it educates the person, this is what an educated person is, and giving it in definitive terms, I'd rather open it up completely and say, well, if we think of every experience as possibly educational, what are the different kinds of education that we can experience? And to me, it's the trickiest answer, because it's not saying that there are clearly experiences that are not educational. Because I just don't know if there are. I think that we can see, you know, these very minor experiences we have quite profound influence on our psyche when they become repetitive, for example. So I think, like, for example, the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, I hate the fact that I've brought it up because everyone's so fed up with it, not least, you know, us, I'm sure. But there are so many aspects of our lives that have changed over the last year. And because of that, and they're obvious ones, they're ones where we've literally had to learn how to change our behaviors, literally had to change our practices, and therefore, you know, almost become different people as teachers or students, for example, through online means of education. But there are also lots of tiny little things that we might not think of as being educational, but that have changed our psyche, that have changed who we are. And if we change our psychic economy, if we change our psyches, if we change our ego, you know, in whatever way that, and our unconscious, of course, as well, if we change them, even out of our control, isn't that education? If our psychic economy is transformed, isn't that a form of education? And I suppose that would be my question and my provocation. Obviously, the caveat to that is there are many educational experiences that within, if we say that every experience has the possibility of becoming educational, that really aren't very interesting, or that aren't worth study, or aren't worth debate, or, you know, so on and so forth. But I guess what I'm interested in is really figuring out, just because they're like, there are so many experiences, doesn't mean that there aren't lots of those kinds of education experiences which are excluded from our more traditional conception of what education is, which are interesting, which are helpful, which are useful to understand in terms of education and in terms of how we are formed as individuals, as subjects.
Right. So I really read your book as an attempt of broadening the notion of education. You describe education as the formation and deformation of the non-stable subject. So maybe the solution could be that not every experience changes the way you are, the way you think about the world, the way you think about yourself, the vocabulary you use to describe yourself and the people around you. But every experience potentially can be education, right? And I really like this impetus of you to go against a constraint of conceptualizing education as only institutionalized or only via an intention, right? That's also a common motive, the intention to change the other person. Or even, I think, you also argue against the concept of education that always includes two people, right? Teacher-student, classic example, that the relation between the teacher and the student, whatever happens there, that is educational. And instead, you describe, for example, what I really liked is that about educational space. So you write, an educational space is not just a space where education happens. It is a space which educates. So it is not necessarily another person, but it can be anything really. The space, an object, a thing, a thought, a dream. And okay, now I cannot think about this question, but that's what I really liked about your book. Do you want to say great. Something, this? Or?
No. That's great. And I think you focus in on a really important part of what I've been talking about and interested in the book, and also since writing the book. And it is this notion of educational space as being much broader than, say, a classroom or a relationship between a teacher and a student. There's something to connect it back to the point that you were making before about how some experiences are, you know, maybe do affect or change the subject. I think my uncertainty around that is, and I agree with you. I think you're largely right there. But I think there's also many experiences that we have as individuals, which are, for example, part of our educational space. You know, part of the space which educates us. The context within which we, you know, expansively exist, that educates us, that we don't necessarily know or understand or could turn into words or formalize. And so in a strange way, like it's a risk, because as a philosopher, you don't want to say, well, everything is one thing and everything is possibly this or whatever, because you want to be clear, you want to be definitive. And when you come to talk about education, you also want to be clear, you want to be definitive. But I think there's so many things which educate us in a way that we can't quite grapple with or understand. And I think that's why research is so important, is precisely to be able to figure those things out. And I think it's one of the reasons why, when I think about educational space, I then go on to talk about conversation, because conversation, like the one that we're having now, is, and all the many different kinds of conversations that we can have, they are quite a wonderful means of getting towards particular kinds of learning, particular kinds of education. And I'm not one of these educationists who's afraid of the word learning. I guess maybe because I'm so far removed from being too concerned about schooling as the only means of education, I'm not so concerned about learnification, for example. But that's another issue. But there's something that happens in conversations, for example, which aren't dialogues, which aren't a form of dialectic, which aren't a form of, you know, you asking me questions and me answering them and then you changing your mind and me changing my mind, and we develop in a kind of dialectical fashion. Conversation, I think, is much looser and freer and more open and less about the individual developing and more about the thought within the conversation developing, which is something that I take from a philosopher called Maurice Blanchot. And I think that's why conversations are such useful devices for being able to understand education in a broader fashion, because we see ourselves change even just within the context of a conversation. And we see how we often come upon all sorts of strange or interesting subjects of conversation without necessarily trying to do so. And I don't know. I mean, certainly for me over this last year, I've been by myself for the large part of it. Conversations with people on the phone have been a huge, an important component of my life. And it's interesting because we often want to speak to each other, not necessarily because we have something to say, but because we want to talk. And why do we want to talk? And maybe it's because we want to feel ourselves. And I guess this is, you know, this is leaning towards quite complex psychological and philosophical territory, so I try not to go down the rabbit hole too far. But I think there's something very important about how we find ourselves in our conversations with other people in unanticipable ways sometimes, in ways that we can't anticipate. And that's, it's something that we could extend to lots of experiences. But one of the reasons why, you know, I do think we can begin to designate between more or less educational experiences in a loose fashion is that some experiences are quite intensively educational. So, and some are clearly decided, you know, it's decided that they should be that way. It's intended, it's intentional, as you were talking about before. It's a very intentional form of education, therefore very intense. And you must learn this, 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 and this, and we will examine you on it to make sure you've learned it. And therefore, you know, you will have been educated in this way. Whereas I think that's one way of having an intensive form of intentional education. But an intensive form of education by another means is, for example, having a conversation with someone, because that, even though you don't necessarily think of it as intensely educational, if there's a back and forth, if there's a kind of development of your own thinking as you're speaking, and I know I'm not alone when I say I often don't know what I think until I say it. I think a lot of people have that experience of thinking, well, it's until I formalize the word, the thoughts as words, I'm like, oh, and I say something sometimes, and I go, yes, that's exactly what I've been thinking and trying to formalize in my own mind. And it's having the opportunity, like this one, for example, where you can formalize your thought and sort of crystallize it a little bit, at least for a moment. That allows you to figure out who you are and what you think and what you believe and, you know, how you are in relation to others. But the important factor when it comes to that formation of yourself is that it's a deformable formation. Just because you've been educated to think that or become that or be that person in at that time and that place and in relation to this person, that doesn't mean that's always going to be what you think or always who you feel that you are. And something that I talk to my undergraduates about a lot, I get an example that I give them of how we change as subjects and how our education forces all kinds of different reactions from us is, you know, I say to them, you know, what's the difference between how you are when you're with your friends who like to, you know, go out and, you know, party or something like that, as opposed to how you are when you're with your family and your grandparents or something like that. You know, how do you change? What kind of subject do you become? What forms of education are you more open to in those particular contexts? Like, how are you, what are you open to talking about? How are you open to developing your thinking, developing who you are in the one context as opposed to the other? So yeah, so that's some of that at least.
Another aspect I really like that you really emphasize the passive side of education, because often, especially nowadays, education is only thought of as being active, doing something, as you said, you know, learning a new skill, which always implies that you have to be an active student. That's also, at least in Germany, something that is only positive, right? To be passive is always thought as negative, because then you don't know, you don't listen in the classroom or whatever. Whereas you really explore the notion of being open for educational experiences without trying to get them, right? And because you told the story about your students, in my seminars, in the first sessions, I sometimes tell them that this might be a beautiful educational experience for them, but not because of what I say or the text we read or something like this, but maybe they will meet the love of their life in this seminar, right? And this will be the most significant change in their life and the most educational one to which reading texts and doing scientific discussions is nothing against. But you cannot control this, right? You have no. It's not that you can say, okay, today I will meet the love of my life. You have to be open for the possibility to occur, so to speak.
Absolutely, and I really like that, Kai. I think that's great. And I would say, yeah, absolutely to that, 100%. And I also add that what we teach, for example, isn't necessarily what's learned. So, I mean, a really easy example that I could give, and you could extend it to almost anything, is, you know, you teach a novel, and there's certain themes that you want to talk about in the novel, and there's certain forms of critique that you want to use to critique the novel and talk with the students about it or something like that. But actually, what they like is a particular description of one of the characters of their experiences, and that has a profound effect on them and changes the way that they think about a relationship that they have, you know, with their, you know, their cousin or something. I mean, you know, just making it up. But there's so many things, especially, you know, and obviously in literature, maybe that's too easy of an example, but in so many forms of education. Which we could limit to formal settings, of course, but also much more broadly, there are all of these things which can, for some strange reason, can just get under your skin, change who you are, change who you think, change how you relate to other people. For example, you know, being open to things through the means of a kind of ethical passivity. What that dictates is not always aggressively being certain about what you're going to take from a particular kind of context. Whereas there's an emphasis very much in culture today. And I think this is something that has been around for a very long time. You know, maybe this is kind of why we go back to classical Rome when we're thinking about the humanist legacy, for example, where you want to control everything. And you want to know what you're getting out of something. And you always have to be active, because if you're not active, you're not making the most of your life. And if you're not active, you're not making the most of the opportunities that have been given to you, and so on and so forth. But it's just it's an existential mistake, because you still have experiences, regardless of whether or not you're active in some kind of superficial sense. Your brain is kind of always working. You know, your psyche is always working. You can't switch your psyche off. You can't switch your unconscious off. That never stops working. So because of that, there's activity in a much broader sense, kind of going on all the time, which is what opens you up. And this is maybe why I say, you know, if you're alive, you're educated, because if you're alive, you're having experiences which are forming your subjectivity, which are forming who you are and how you think and how you feel and how you relate to others. And so for me, I don't know if I want to go on, but too much down that rabbit hole. But I totally agree with your example. As like this is the point when we're thinking about context. Like I make that, you know, I always talk about the point where so much education happens in the corridors at school. You know, corridors are very interesting parts of schools because they're not educational areas, and yet so many conversations happen there. So many pieces of gossip are shared, or negative experiences happen in them as well. And schools are designed, of course, to be kind of conditioning tools. And then we have, you know, very advanced forms of schools that are being developed, which are much more open and trying to kind of open out from that more disciplinary form of architecture. But both of those forms of educational context, even without a single lesson going on in them, even without a teacher present, when the student walks through the school, they have a particular kind of experience that has some effect on them. And there's two things that are going on. So firstly, that educational space, you know, this very limited formal educational space, is having an educational effect on the subject. But another thing that can have an educational effect on the subject is if they become conscious of the work that that building is doing on them. So if you become conscious of the fact that so many things in your life are educating you, are changing who you are forming your subjectivity, or doing some work to deform your subjectivity, you become much more able to, like, this is the irony, is you become much more able to be aware of who you're becoming and who you are and what matters and so on and so forth than you would be if you're really always working with intention and you're always thinking, okay, well, this is what I want to do, and this is, you know, by being more open, by being more passive in some ways, you can actually become more critical. And you can actually become more aware of what's going on and how you're changing as a person. But anyway, yeah, so I won't dwell on that anymore.
So I want to stay on with this motive of passivity a little, and then I promise I will come back to your book and also to your title. But this is probably a very German question, but actually the person who first used the word Bildung Meister Eckhart, right? He thought of Bildung as totally passive, because you have to make you free for God to come inside you. So it's not something that you can actively pursue, but you have to wait until it happens. And being open to the unforeseen miracle, the wonder that God finally enters your life, is the only way, he claims, to become the picture of God, which is Bildung, right? The word for picture, the German word for picture. So, well, this is a bit theological, but I think this really has a huge potential for offering different ways to think about education than the most hegemonic ways.
Absolutely.
Today.
I love that example. I quite like Meister Eckhart, and I like some of that mystical Christian thought, even though I'm not a Christian myself. But I find that mystical Christian thought is often, it doesn't really, I don't know, it's often very philosophical and very open, and quite in strange ways kind of existential, but that's the complex theological philosophical discussion, which I, you know, this isn't the place to have it, but I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's interesting. And this is an example of, you know, I haven't thought about Meister Eckhart in years. I remember reading some of his stuff years ago, and when I was reading Dag Hammarskjöld's Markings, which is an excellent book. You know, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the Secretary General of the UN, he wrote this very interesting book, it's worth reading as a an analysis of someone's subjectivity, which is so distinct from who they are as a public figure. But anyway, and he was a big reader of Eckhart, so I ended up looking up Eckhart and reading some Eckhart. So that's enough of a story around that. But I think what's interesting is that, yeah, I think what you describe, I mean, obviously it has this theological undertones, which I wouldn't want to take in that direction, but I still think it's interesting, and this idea of building as passivity, because of course that's not what building has become, and the way that building is now discussed. And obviously building isn't actually, in the UK and the US, it's not actually a concept that we use very often, even in the more restricted and contemporary sense. But even from my understanding, at least, and it's, you know, it's not actually a subject of deep analysis for me, but building has become quite a much more restrained and even active concept for subject to describe subject formation. So even though it's distinct from other forms of education, it's maybe strayed from Meister Eckhart's original intentions. Would that be a correct assessment?
I think this is the perfect way of coming back to the title, because I would claim that it is actually the human's legacy that completely turned the term around, and by Wilhelm von Humboldt, who conceptualized Bildung more like in a gym, right? There is the world, and then we have to work with the world in order to improve ourselves, to make ourselves better, to build skills and ways of knowing the world and ways of knowing, but it's almost as training a muscle. the world is only the object of our the subject's will to improve, and this is, I think, what you want to argue against, and also a way of thinking about education that you offer some alternatives to. And this brings us back to the title, Against and Outside the Humanist Legacy. And maybe you can tell a bit, we talked about some of the motives, but maybe you can give a bit of an overview of your attempt of being outside of this legacy.
Yeah, no, I'd love to do that. And just quickly, just to kind of go back on your gym analogy, and another one which commonly comes into play when talking about education, which is, you know, seeing the person as growing like a plant or a flower or something like that. these very linear forms of development that are based around really particular forms of sustenance or action. What doesn't a muscle or a plant have? It doesn't have a psyche, you know? And so, like, it doesn't have a psychic economy. So that's what makes us so complicated. And that's what makes our education such a mess. And also so exciting, because we're not these beings who have this ability to simply, or these, you know, these muscles or, you know, limbs, that we have these limbs, but that's not what makes us interesting. I think that's it's, and there's so much damaging rhetoric, I think, partly around things like this, you know, building your mind like you would a muscle in the gym, which is something that's, you know, people still talk about things like this. And it was actually quite influential in the 19th century in England, around the foundations of compulsory schooling. There was a lot of rhetoric around the body being, the mind being like the body, and the education of the spirit being like the education of the body, and all this kind of stuff. And the plant metaphor I also hate. So these are very restricted. And I think, if we want to talk very straightforwardly, or give a kind of basic distinction between the kinds of education, you know, education within the humanist legacy, that would be this model of, you know, almost like the mind as the bodybuilder or something like that, you know, and you know, you build yourself up and make yourself, you know, clever and skillful and able to engage in all these aspects of social life and all this kind of stuff, and in a manner that's very restricted and has to be based on like really particular stages and content and so on. So, like, you know, let's say, you know, the humanist legacy is the bodybuilder. Sorry, this is ridiculous, I know, but maybe entertaining for some, maybe horrendous for others. But let's say that's what it is. It's this notion, very connected to what you describe as Humboldtian building. And we're not just in Germany, but in the way that that's been adapted or developed in other countries as well. So what's outside, you know, what's outside of that? And as I've kind of made reference to several times before, I think for me, what's outside the humanist legacy is actually what's inside our minds, which is the psychic economy, and which is the fact that there are things going on in our minds and in the relations that we have with others that have this kind of feedback loop with our minds. There are relations with the objects that we encounter, or the spaces that we exist in, or, you know, that we exist in and as, in some ways as well, that really shape who we are. And so, thinking of education, and specifically educational experience, I put the emphasis on educational experience because I kind of want to say, I'm not just talking about practice. You know, of course, when you say education, people think, oh, well, you're talking about educational practices. But actually, I want to emphasize that it's the experience that is the important thing there. So that's why I put that in the title. So when we're thinking about education and educational experience outside of the humanist legacy, and one of the things that I do is kind of say, well, you know, we can't really get outside it because it's so pervasive, and it's octopus tentacles kind of reach into so many aspects of our lives. And one important factor, which, and I always like to say this before I go into discussing the outside, is say, well, the means by which I'm able to define an outside partly come from and are inherited from the humanist legacy. So, like, I, as an educated subject in this kind of vague general sense, am also a relatively educated subject within the very restricted sense of the humanist legacy as well. And I'm putting the education that I've received as a result of that legacy into practice by analyzing and critiquing the thing that I also am. So, like, it's so that there's yet another feedback loop in this, a necessary self-critique that has to be undergone when considering these things, and that we can't simply jump outside the humanist legacy. We can't exit it because it shapes who we are. But what we can do, I think, is think about the experiences that are in some ways not defined as education within the remit of education today, what I call the humanist legacy and the influence of the humanist legacy. And in so doing, we begin to open our minds to educational experiences that puncture, disrupt, offer opportunities, give us optimism for other ways of being in and of ourselves, but also in relation to other people. So what my hope is, and this is kind of, I do talk a little bit, I do have some kind of utopian or quasi-utopian thought that I examine in this text. And it's that I believe that if we move towards considering experiences that exceed our traditional conception of education, and we move towards those experiences and think of them as educational, it unsettles the dominance and power, I think, as well, of those dominant modes of education. And it makes them kind of, it puts them on the same plane. It makes us really have to consider why and when and how we put them into action. And if we even should sometimes or many times. And so that education that we experience outside of the humanist legacy, it's like, it's everything that we don't define by that. You know, and this is why I end up being quite open and I guess open-minded. And even, yeah, I mean, at the risk of sounding, going back to the kind of very open-ended description of that all experiences have the possibility of becoming educational, and perhaps even are in a way that we can't understand, or that we wouldn't be able to put into words or whatever, you know. That's what I mean by the outside. So simply in terms of description, I would say the stuff we were talking about before is how we would describe the outside. You know, it is the experiences of education that aren't compartmentalized within the humanist legacy. But I have another reason for using that term, the outside. You know, I'm saying outside, not just to say there are experiences outside the humanist legacy. I'm using that word because, and concerned about this outside, because I don't just think it's useful to say, yes, there are experiences that exceed the humanist legacy. I think it's important to understand the profound effect that they have on us and have on us as educated subjects. And I guess that there's some real work that I'm trying to do myself, and that I'm seeing more and more people, you know, kind of wanting to do, which is really examining things that shape who we are that aren't, that we have some control over, and that we have, and that we can shut in or shut out, or be open to or not be open to, or can change for other people in positive or negative ways, that really don't fit our ordinary conception of education or subject formation. And because of that, I think it becomes difficult for us to think about the educated subject in a sufficiently broad manner as to be able to understand them as people. And so what we tend to do, and you know, the irony, of course, is that I tell psychology in my book, but what we tend to do is we tend to psychologize or even pathologize individuals who don't succeed in the way that we have come to determine success in our societies. And I guess, I don't know, yeah, so the outside is, it's something that exceeds our conventional way of thinking about education, so forms of education that, you know, we've talked about at length, what those might be. So it's that, but it's also kind of trying to say, well, maybe we need to take some ownership of this outside as well. And that doesn't mean kind of pull it into the humanist legacy and say, okay, well, we need to accumulate this and teach more about this. Quite the opposite, actually. It's more beginning to understand it, and therefore maybe beginning to find ways to improve the conditions of social and individual life more broadly, in a manner that doesn't just rely on traditional forms of education.
So one of the notions you offer outside the humanist legacy is the one of conversation. And I found this, it's the last chapter in your book, and I found this really interesting and stimulating, and maybe also a bit irritating, because one could easily think of a way to conceptualize conversation in a very humanistic way, right? As dialogue between individuals, or the back and forth between the subject and the world, but you offer quite a different concept. Can you maybe talk about this?
Yeah, so I mean, I mentioned it briefly before, and it's I'm glad to be able to come back to it, because I think it's a crucial component of the book, and it's a really important aspect of the understanding educational experience for me. And I think what conversation, kind of what I was saying before about how conversation doesn't necessarily develop the subject in an obvious sense, in the same way dialogue or dialectic would. It doesn't necessarily create an understanding or a shared understanding or a conclusion. What it does is it allows the subject, the interlocutors, let's say, rather than subjects, to move with their thought. And what for Blanchot and Maurice Blanchot, the philosopher that I kind of draw on, and to be able to make some of these claims, what he argues is that thought is what moves within the conversation. And that's important because it's not the subject that develops, it's thought that develops. And the subject can be formed and deformed in that context. We can change our reactions, who we are, what our mood is, all of these things within the designation of what we might call the conversation. And it's an opportunity, really. Conversations are an opportunity to engage in a kind of dissimulation of yourself. So not a shoring up of yourself, not a kind of, okay, well, let's have this dialogue or dialectic where, I'm going to grow as an individual and, you're going to help me, which is the kind of typical kind of student-teacher dialogue or something like that. But rather where, somewhat obviously, and we know this, and even people who write about dialogue know this, is that, of course, the teacher can also be educated when teaching. We know this, right? So the teacher can learn from teaching. And in fact, that's ironically one of the things that Rousseau says, is why one person should only ever teach one other person. Because what happens when you teach one other person, this is Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Emile, he says that a teacher should only ever teach one other person, because what they'll do is they'll transpose the lessons that they've learned from teaching that one child onto the next child that they teach. And that would be terrible, because they should be able to be open and responsive to the individual child in a way that hasn't taken too much from the first education. I actually quite love that, because it's such a crazy idea, but it kind of makes sense. Not that I'm particularly informed by Rousseau's thoughts, certainly not in my book, but it's a kind of funny example of how once we begin to create a pattern of the way that we engage with other people, we begin to limit what we can then offer to that person and possibly impose too many of these restrictive ways of teaching or just relating onto other people. And I think what conversation, certainly in the way that Blanchot describes it, in the way that I try and kind of pick it up, is it gets away from really any kind of formalized engagement with another person, whereas dialogue and dialectic, and we know this from the history of philosophy as well, when we look at the various forms of dialogue that exist, some more famous than others, exist throughout the history of philosophy, where there's this very clear mechanism of development. And often, as in the Platonic dialogues, there's clearly the one who knows, and then there are the one or ones who are being taught to know through the dialogue. So they, in the end, they usually end up agreeing or, kind of going, oh, yes, well, of course, Socrates, you're right. And that's a kind of very limited form of dialogue, of course. But then you've got more complex forms of dialectic or dialogue that develop much later as well, and which are directed towards often still the same thing, really, which is the development of the subject in a particular way, sometimes two subjects developing together. But it's always linear, and it's always connected to this idea of developing, formalizing, limiting the subject in some way. Whereas I think conversation, it breaks down our defenses in some way. Because conversational thought isn't necessary. It can be confrontational, I guess, in certain instances. But one thing that it absolutely isn't, and I'm at risk of becoming right now, is monologic. So what happens in dialogue is that it often, what a dialogue is or a dialectic is alternating monologues. I think this, this is my position on this. And that's seen as kind of a good philosophical model sometimes. Whereas really what conversation does is it's not about what I think. It's about where the conversation goes. And if you stop worrying about trying to get your point across and you start thinking about, well, where can your thought take you? Where can these words that are available to us, where can your responsiveness and my responsiveness to the thoughts that you're having and I'm having, Where can that take us? And obviously, I mean, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's obvious to me, maybe not to others. But that's so much more exciting than coming into a conversation and know exactly what your conversation or dialogue or just an interaction with another person and just saying what you think and they think what they think and you get no further. Often, or you end up having the same, you know, quote unquote conversation every time you speak to someone, and it becomes incredibly dull because they're not willing to move with the thought, or you're not willing to move with the thought. So that's why I think conversation is such a valuable educational context, and also such a kind of touchstone context of educational experience for thinking educational experience outside the humanist legacy, because it's so removed from any linear development subject. And often it's precisely where it puts into question some of the things that you take for granted or some of the ways of being that you have begun to just, you know, or not begun, but that you've developed, and therefore you maybe sometimes would find it useful to dissimulate in some way, to evaporate slightly and to find, maybe test out other ways of thinking or other ways of being. So that's what I see conversation partly as offering the opportunity to do.
Well, Emil, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I hope this interview was not too unconversational. But my last question is, what are you working on right now?
So, thank you, Kai. And thank you so much for having me on the program. It's been really wonderful to be able to talk about these things. And it's a real pleasure. And your questions have been fantastic, and not ones that I would have anticipated, actually, all of them. So that's been really nice. But what I'm working on now, one of the main things I'm working on now is actually in my role at the university as one of the research managers. I'm working on what's called the REF submission, which is this research excellence framework that UK universities engage in, which is quite time consuming and has taken me away from my research. It's an interesting process, and I've learned a lot from it, but I'm very much looking forward to getting back to some research. But I have been working on a couple of papers which are testing out some new ideas. And one of the papers, it's actually just been accepted for publication in a journal called Educational Philosophy and Theory. It's on educational resistance. And what it tries to look at is how we might see resistance to all sorts of things. And, you know, the paper can cover that ground more thoroughly than I will here. How we can see resistance as educational. How we can see resisting sometimes education itself, certainly in its dominant forms. How we can see that resistance as educational in itself. And so I've looked into that concept a little bit. I'm also writing a paper on ignorance at the moment. I read a paper called Positive Ignorance a couple of years ago, and I've been asked to follow that up for a collection on the vices and virtues in education and kind of turning them on their heads. It's an interesting collection, actually. One of the things that I'm trying to do with both of these papers is do something a little bit new with my own work. And one of the things I'm trying to do is incorporate sound a little bit into these articles. And what that means is using sound as a means of doing philosophical research and as a kind of appendix to the more traditional philosophical research that I'm doing in the articles themselves. And that's something, I mean, I write about it a bit more in the articles, but maybe this is something that might interest a couple of listeners that might go, oh, well, I wasn't so interested in what he was saying about the book, but this thing he says about sound, that might be interesting. So, you know, it's something that I'm exploring. I say a lot more about that in these papers. Because I also work in sound and music. So this is another interest of mine. So I'm trying to find ways to show how, and this connects to some of the things that I've talked about when it comes to experience and educational experience more broadly, seeing living in sound as a kind of form of educational experience. So that's what I'm working on now.
Well, thank you, Emil. That sounds very interesting. And thank you very much for joining me on New Books in Education.
Thank you very much, Kai. It's been an absolute pleasure.